And welcome once again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 8. Now, before we begin, we cannot forget that we live and work in Skrempukulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Skrempuk people. Every day, it becomes clear that doing the best we can to resolve this historical injustice is a critical responsibility for all of us. Now, today we have the pleasure of welcoming back a favorite guest on Food Conversations, someone who plays an important role in this community as we work towards food security and food sovereignty for everyone. Melanie Bennett is the project and volunteer coordinator for the Shuswap Food Action Society, and she contributes every day and in multiple practical ways to facilitating the efforts of the food-producing sector to enhancing the values of equity and fairness around food availability and production, and to raising her young children to be good and enlightened citizens. Melanie, we've never tire of having you with us in the guest chair. Welcome back to Food Conversations.
Thank you. It's very nice to be back. That was an amazing welcome, and I'm blushing, of course, because...
Thank God it's radio.
Thank goodness I have such an incredible team, or I'm a part of a team that is doing all that work.
Which is a theme that should run through just about everything we do in our lives. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to have it happening here. Now, I mentioned your kids because when we were talking on Zoom the other day, your son was in and out of the room with questions and comments and waving things. And you had this big smile on your face. And I thought, you know, how that ties into broad notions of Mother Nature and Pachamama, you know, this idea of... which we repeatedly talk about on Food Conversation, speculate about the expanding role of women in changing social structures and doing a lot of transformational work. Do you ever feel like that? Do you ever feel like you're part of this ancient tradition of nurturing and respecting others, collaborating? All these are qualities that women really are sometimes a lot better at than men. It doesn't mean that we don't have a place, but anyway, there you are.
Well, certainly, as we see certain types of organizations, I mean, if we're looking at the nonprofit sector, you're probably going to see a lot more women. And if that's the role that we play, the nurturer, I think that's a wonderful role. And yeah. Yes, we can't generalize too much, but in our organization, predominantly, we have a one male, Howie, who's been on the show as well, who is a grandfather and a father. But for the rest of the roles of everyone playing it, they are women and they are moms.
Yeah, especially women, I guess because of, not that every woman has to have a child, but that there's an understanding that your body can do some things that you don't have much control over, but it's part of the nature of things. And just that vulnerable people, you know, very small babies and people who are having trouble fitting into the social matrix, women often have a better grasp of that. They can sense what it's like. Maybe it's because in many societies, women are marginalized in very serious ways. But it's just a sense of understanding.
There's a drive, I'm sure. There's no doubt there's some sort of biological drive. You know, a woman hears a baby cry and there's a different sort of physical action that takes place. And yet, too, just within our community, I mean, thank goodness we have some incredible men here, too,
Absolutely.
Who are doing great work.
Absolutely. So, and I don't mean to imply that women are trapped in their biology. That's just
No. It's just, it is, there. I think there is a biological part. And yeah. I know that, you know, we had a sort of board retreat many months ago at our new executive director's place. And we discussed, like, why are we doing this? Why are we here? And predominantly the answer is that we are looking at our own children and also others' children. Mm-hmm. So you're right. Like, you don't have to have children to want to take care of the planet, the world, people. There's though a sense that we are looking at what are our kids going to inherit? What is their future? And that is what drives us ferociously.
Yes. It's been well identified a long time ago that the biggest and most engaged demographic, if you want to call it, that cares about what we're doing to the planet and to ourselves is women with young children, because you see their vulnerability, you see their future. The other thing that Mother Nature does, of course, is sends us corrections. And they're often the result of us doing something that messed something up, and then Mother Nature just says, sorry, you're going to poison yourselves, and now you've just done it, and doesn't that feel bad, and maybe you shouldn't do that. And I think this idea of a planetary mother being always nurturing and kind is, of course, something we have to not think is the old story.
Oh, no. Mother Nature can also slap us down pretty good, just like moms can be very upset with their children.
Very directive.
I'm so happy that you saw me smiling yesterday when my children were asking me questions, and I don't want to paint a terribly rosy picture thinking we're so involved in food security, that means our kids must be like happily growing gardens and eating absolutely all the nutritious food that we eat,
right.
Because it is definitely a challenge. And this work we do passionately, but we also are trying to raise our kids with a certain thought process and integrity. And I'm challenged often by it. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, I get these beautiful glimpses that they... when they repeat something that I've said, oh my goodness, does that ever just make my heart swell? And I'm just like, thank goodness it is happening. Like, my kids do not want to grow a garden.
Uh-huh.
And I made a mistake when they were young and I was gardening, because I was in such a hurry. Everything I do is in such a hurry all the time. And that is that's my downfall. And it makes it so that for my kids, especially, they turn away from it a bit, but they're coming back. My son grew a garden this year. We went
and
through
said he
seeds,
liked it.
He got into it. And my daughter is this year. We went through some seeds, and she's excited now. So, if I could ever offer any advice to a parent who's looking at feeding their children, growing a garden, any of those things, is just take your time, be slow, try not to rush them too much, and that be patient, because it will happen eventually.
You know, the rhythms of nature don't always go in a straight line. They go all over the place. They dipsy doodle. And one of the things that I'm sure every parent has felt is that today this isn't going well.
Mm-hmm.
But tomorrow is another day.
That's right.
And I think it's such an antithesis of the way we kind of market things that we want to sell. We want to get people to change the way we want them to be. You have this notion after a while, okay, whatever happened today is today's. But tomorrow will be another day. I remember that there's this tradition, the British tradition, of what they call remittance men. It was all men. And they were men who were being so obstreperous and disruptive and violent and whatever that they got a chunk of money as long as they went a long way away to a colony far, far away on what was essentially another planet. And it's sort of the antithesis of how women often end up relating to children. They say, well, you know, he's in jail right now, but, you know, one of these days he'll get out, and he's saying that he wished he hadn't done what he did, you know, and let's work on that. Let's work with that rather than... And that's the collaboration side, which I think is really a big deal that we have to sort of focus our attention on. Now,
and I like what you said, though, too. Like, we often think people should do certain things. We want people to... Like, we'll bring this and segue back into food action and anything that we're doing in our community. And it's, we have these beliefs on what we want people to be doing.
Yes.
And it doesn't always work as smoothly or as quickly as we would like it to. So we just have to keep plugging away, keep being patient, and believe that it will all happen.
Well, I think it's inherent to believe that there is progress possible in any area. It's just, it's built into us. But nevertheless, I want to ask you one question, which is very down to earth.
Okay.
And that is, I seem to remember you being the project manager and project coordinator, but now project and volunteer. Is that an expansion of your title, or did I just
actually
miss it before?
You know, I probably still have to write my job description is very broad, and it ranges, because I do social media. I do the web. I do a lot of different things.
Right.
And at this point now, we've even changed our title of what we do from projects mm-hmm. to programs. And what the difference is there is, like, a project is usually a single thing, whereas a program is something that you do in continuity.
Right.
That's the growth trajectory that we're going to discuss in this hour, is the fact that we've gone from single projects to programs. And that makes a big difference. So the volunteer part, too, we've actually found an amazing volunteer who helps us with that, and that's Nan. And she helps because she's done almost everything. And so she can get the information when we have a volunteer intake. She receives it. She will call them. She'll either email or call. Sometimes she'll meet them for coffee. She will find a way, a place, and based on what they're interested in, and she will get them started. And that is in its own entire role, which I generally oversee. But still, I'm not part of the volunteers with the school meal programs. They do their own thing, too.
Isn't it interesting how somebody who's been around the block a few times can actually say, well, I have a solution to that problem that you guys are wrestling with, because we did this 10 or 15 years ago and it worked pretty well. But let's talk a little bit also about volunteers and staff. People who get paid for what they do, because you said the nonprofit sector has women in it, so the implication maybe women do things without being paid because you do so much anyway. But also women are getting paid for doing what they're doing. CAPE has a staff of something like 18 now. We used to be about 3 or 4. And all of them get paid for doing what they do. Why just compare and contrast volunteers and staff and why both are necessary?
Yes. So they are both absolutely vital. And we've gotten to that point where that is absolutely true. We all started as volunteers with Shoe Shop Food Action Society. And you do as much as you can. At the time, my kids were still very young. They weren't in school yet. And it gets to a point, though, when you're going to start devoting so much time to something that you have to sort of make a choice. And in order to make anything grow or last or have sustainability, you do have somebody who's dedicated to it. And you can't really do that very well with just volunteers. Now, yeah. I will give a shout out to the folks at Second Harvest. And Val, she's been doing it for a long time as a volunteer.
Indeed.
It's incredible, but it's a very rare thing. And so we now have grown so much that we absolutely must have staff to make these programs work, especially the school meal programs, because you have to have somebody who is thinking about all the details and taking it from the start to the very end and completing, and in a time frame too, right? Because with the school meals, like, there's a very finite time.
Indeed.
And with the
and
super
schools
meals,
have bells that ring.
Yeah,
when,
like, it has to be done when it's done. And if a volunteer can't show up, which, you know, we are very, very relaxed about our, like, as far as schedules.
But some things have to happen.
We have to have things done in a certain amount of time, and there's a lot of work. And so, yeah, we absolutely have staff now, and we're really proud of that. We love that growth that we've had.
I'll remind listeners that I'm speaking with Melanie Bennett, who is the project and volunteer coordinator for the Shoe Shop Food Action Society. I would like to do a segue into volunteers and staff and talk about a project that we definitely are going to talk about at some length now, and that's the coldest night of the year. The coldest night of the year involves volunteers, involves staff, and it involves reaching out into the community and drawing people who voluntarily bring in funding that makes the work of the Shoe Shop Food Action Society possible and the expansion of services and programs and projects possible. So let's talk about the coldest night of the year. It's a clear example. This is a fifth year that it's been in place.
For us, it's been in San Marino for much longer.
Absolutely. But well, since you're here today,
yes,
we're going to talk about it for you guys. It's fifth year. It's on February the 22nd. Tell listeners sort of the basic parameters of coldest night of the year. I might mention, by the way, that mm-hmm. Melanie is wearing a sweatshirt, carrying a swag bag, and had toque.
Last year's toque, too.
And yes,
I'm still waiting for this year's toque. I'm very excited. It's a nice toque.
Oh, well, nice.
They're
toques.
All nice toques, but this year's toque is one that you actually want to wear probably all the time, which is nice. It's a little less, it's a little more subtle.
Subtle is good.
So yes, this is our fifth anniversary that Shoe Shop Food Action Society is hosting Coldest Night of the Year. It's been around since 2011. Mm-hmm. There's information about how Coldest Night started on the Blue Sea, the Coldest Night website. But for us, it came to us because it was sort of released by other charities in town. It does take a considerable amount of coordination to make like a big community event, right?
That's right.
And so I took on that role back in 2020 when it came to us. They offered it because we became a charity. And that's really the only way that you can actually host it is you have to be a charity.
Yeah. A very significant step that the government is often unwilling to take, but which organizations, when they derive it, are really doing much better. It helps a lot.
So I took on that role. And you know, it was 2020, all that happened. And it became a virtual event, so we couldn't actually gather. But it still worked, you know, it still happened, and it exceeded our expectations. It gave us a sense like, wow, the community can support us, and we could grow, and we were really excited about that. And so, you know, when I look back to the trajectory of what we were doing then to what we're doing now, we can absolutely say 100% that Coldest Night of the Year is what has allowed us to grow. And so it is incredibly important that we continue to do
pivotal.
Pivotal. We would love at some point to grow to a point where we actually have a different kind of funding method, whether it's contributions from organizations. We would love to be able to at some point release Coldest Night of the Year back to another charity in town. But it is, like you said, it is still ultimately pivotal for us.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if the public funding source, the biggest of all, which is the government in a municipal, provincial, and federal jurisdiction, says, this is part of what we do. We do support activities, that the kind of activities being initiated by nonprofit groups or volunteers or people who just care about something.
It would be wonderful.
That's, well, it does happen.
And it is happening, and it does happen, and it will happen.
Yes, indeed.
We see it. I think, you know, we were still fairly unknown. We were small. We were just volunteers. We were doing good things, but it was still small. Yeah. And I think there's a point where a charity has to grow to become sort of trustworthy, so to speak. You know what? If people are going to donate money to you, they want to know that you're going to do something with it.
And you know, it's a sign that you're doing something that matters.
Yes.
When you find people just generally starting to talk about you as if you were part of the way things are.
The fabric.
And
of
I've
the
seen that happen in the healthcare sector, where somebody decides a particular condition needs to be addressed. Nobody's doing it. Governments and official bodies are just saying, yeah, that's important, but we're busy. And then one day something clicks and they say, the work to be done by this nonprofit is really important.
Yeah.
We're going to take it on and support it formally and officially. It's going to become part of what we do.
I see that happening. I think it will happen. And I have belief in that. And I mean, we have actually United Way, because our new, if you remember, well, you'd have to listen back to past episodes, everyone. But Liz Blakeway was on, and we're sharing her with, as an executive director, with Land to Table, which is the North Okanagan Food Security Initiative. So, you know, and that is being helped and assisted by United Way. So it is happening. Food security is top of mind. We are seeing that through the OCP languaging. We know it's true because the growth of the amount of people needing food services. Absolutely. Food security is top of mind, and it's going to continue to be because there's no downward trend on prices of food.
And we have to change the system that makes food present in people's lives in some fashion. There's different ways to do it, but it has to happen because people do have to eat.
And I do want to just kind of just come back quickly and make one more, because I have this microphone right now that we often are asked, you know, why is Shoe Shop Food Action Society hosting Coldest Night of the Year? I thought it was more about homelessness. And yes, it started that way, and it's grown and adapted just like everything does to, you know, to its tagline, which is the hungry, the hurting, and the homeless. And this event is hosted actually in 190 cities in Canada, and it's moved into the United States now. So the actual event itself is across Canada, hosted by many different charities. And I believe the statistic is around 60% of the charities hosting it actually have more to do with like a food bank or a community kitchen or something food related.
Yeah.
And then thankfully in BC too, the assistance, though I don't know if anybody will ever truly solve the problem of homelessness, because it's a very broad issue. There's no one single thing that defines why a person is homeless.
There are societies where homelessness doesn't or didn't happen, and they were often indigenous societies because everybody was expected to participate. They had responsibilities and they had a return, which was that they are included.
And so we have a government approach at the moment at trying to help with, you know, with BC Housing, with the shelters. So, you know, there are people trying to work on it, but it's a very large, complex problem.
So let's remind listeners of some of the features of Coldest Night of the Year. It's an event.
Mm-hmm.
It happens on the 22nd of February in this coming year. It involves walking. Where do we walk? And
So the event itself is a community event. It is free for anybody to participate. You have to register
important
to be a walker,
principle.
But mm-hmm. It is absolutely open to everyone. Whereas when it first started, you paid a registration fee and that received you your toque. That was a part of the sort of symbolism of it. At this point now, you can register for free. And if you want to do some fundraising, that's how you are gifted your toque with a minimum donation amount. So that's how that works. But mm-hmm. as far as the event itself, you register to become a walker. We have this really fun opening ceremonies at downtown Saskatoon.
On the steps of the Saskatoon.
Yeah, and our lead sponsors who have been since the very beginning, Askews and Saskatoon, I want to say thank you. They have great faith
Askews
in
and
us.
Saskatoon.
And so we started there. We do a fun walk where we go all the way from downtown to the fairgrounds. We stop at the Salvation Army, which is where we have a collaboration of the Food Forest. And then they come back down and last year we closed the street at Lakeshore in front of Askews, and we serve a locally sourced meal under tents and with everybody. And it's, you know, it's 2 kilometers or a 5 kilometer walk, whichever you prefer. And it's just really fun to see the entire group. We have a video on our website now, and it shows some aerial footage that we got from John Moss or John Bantock with Moss Media. And so there's a video that really shows like
the crowd streaming down.
Yeah, and I want to see every year it gets bigger and bigger, right? So this huge mass of people who are walking down the highway with their signs showcasing who they are. And just it really, I think, brings the community together, and something that everyone can participate in.
And the atmosphere is so congenial.
Yeah.
Everybody's there feeling good about what they're doing. It's kind of like the fall fair and the other community events, the Roots and Blues. Everybody's really there to have a good time,
yeah,
and to feel good about what they're doing. There's nothing better than that.
Yeah.
Now, we won't go into the whole legend of Stone Soup, mm-hmm. but I gather it's going to be expanded a little bit. The soup department is.
I have ideas. Yeah. I'm not quite ready yet, but that's the thing. Every year we try and improve upon the event. We want it to get bigger and better and more fun, and of course, because we are Food Action and Eat Local is our brand. We go hyper local on our meal and really
door.
Showcasing, you know, all of that. So I have some ideas for the Stone Soup this year, but I'm not quite ready to say them yet.
All right, folks, if you want to hear the full scoop, you can come out on February the 22nd
tuned.
And you'll find out what's been percolating through Melanie's mind. Now, it starts at 4 p.m. and it ends at 7 p.m. But I must admit, when I've been part of it, it's and Tom and I have both attended very routinely. It doesn't really end at 7. If there's soup left, I must confess again on radio that I have actually gone back for several repeat cupfuls of
They're
the soup.
Small cups. It's okay.
They're very small. I don't feel overly guilty. Now, it does play a really important role for the Food Action Society. Mm-hmm. It's a major source of funding. What's the sort of ballpark figure over the years that has been, it's gone up? Slowly
every
steadily.
Year, yep. Yeah.
So what's the sort of ballpark trend of your budget from Coldest Night of the Year?
Every year I would say it's roughly $10,000 to $15,000 more.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were going to bring up our level this year, but we kept it modest. Mm-hmm. You know, we know that there's a lot going on. We know it's really challenging. I mean, even with speaking to businesses, everyone is really looking inward this year. Mm. And they are... they're having to really decide how they're going to allocate funds. So we're very aware that it's not
easy. You're talking about businesses in the community. And
businesses
kind of
and people. Everyone is really having to look hard at what they choose to spend their money on. And we understand and we know that, you know, there's a lot of different places that people could choose to donate their money.
You know, when it's in your heart, the choice is made inside. You just do it. And I think it's a question not of promoting something alone, I mean, telling people that something's happening so they can participate, but it's a change in their own heart that takes place, and they say, I want to do something positive. And I think there's a lot of thinking like that going on these days.
It also depends on how you are personally affected by something.
Mm-hmm.
You give your time, talent, or treasures to organizations that you feel personally connected to, and thank goodness, you know.
I can remember time, talent, and treasures. That's a good line. I'm going to use it somewhere.
I think
it might
be in the Bible. I'm not sure, to be honest.
Oh, my God. Started early. So let's since we're talking about funding mm-hmm. and how important it is in the CNOY, coldest night of the year is a critical part of that, let's talk about how there is a sort of slow and steady expansion of the programs of the Food Action Society. Let's talk about the school system. Because
that's slow and steady? It's been explosive and expansive.
A slow explosion of expansion, yes. School system is now playing a significant role in the work of the Food Action Society. Yeah. Mary Rodriguez is playing an important role there. And inside the school system, Serena Kaner, the former president mm-hmm. of CAPE.
Food Action. Yeah.
The Food Action Society. So let's talk about some aspect. The hot lunch programs, fairly significant venture. How does that operate?
So yeah, back to, you know, when it started, it was Foodie Friday at Jackson High School. One single hot soup. Right during then, you know, because schools got shut down and their kids weren't able to go out for lunches or anything. And so that was, you know, Serena was like, we'll do a soup day. A big part of that is, you know, free for everyone. So that's where we're heading. We need this to be universal. We need this to be stigma free. But it started with just Jackson High School. And so one single day to now where Jackson High School does
three
4
schools.
Days a week,
yes.
Where we have Shuswap Middle School with 3 days a week. South Canoe Elementary with 1 day a week. And that's where we actually have a cook in-house. So not every school can have a cook in-house because they don't have a kitchen.
And that's part of the issue here, that this is building a system where there is no system.
Mm-hmm.
And so each school is a little different. Each has different facilities. They have different participants, yeah. different ways of doing
it. And different capacity and different amounts of students. I mean, some of these schools are huge.
It means more work for you. You have to, not you, but the society, yeah. you have to adapt to each of these different venues and say, well, okay, we'll deliver this here and there and that kind of thing.
And, you know, I'm going to give, you know, Serena so much credit because she started all of this as a vision, you know, of what could be. And she as a dietitian, she was able to do some assessments through Interior Health to actually sort of understand what schools had what, where, you know, what were they lacking. And so she was able to do some of those assessments to have an understanding of what could happen and getting, you know, Serena was able to sort of see that eventually there would be some funding. Eventually there would be provincial or federal funding. It's just going to have to happen. And so she got the school meal program started with the vision. So build it and they will come kind of idea. And so between just the in-house with the super meals, really that came down to we have all these local ingredients. Let's make soup.
Just remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Melanie Bennett, the project and volunteer coordinator for the Shuswap Food Action Society. Now the name, Super Meals.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, tell the readers, listeners out there, how you came up with the name.
I mean, isn't that clever?
No. It is clever.
It's out there too. I mean, that was Serena as well. And she had visions of, I think at one point she had visions of like a superhero kind of going through the schools. Because the biggest thing is like,
food.
How do you get kids interested in food? Mm-hmm. That's the biggest thing. And it's for her, for Mary, for all of our cooks. And I'm sure you know too, you start cooking soup inside the school and you have the onions and garlic sautéing and it makes it a transformative difference between
Absolutely.
The kids being actually interested. And there are kids, I mean, it's hard for me to believe, but there are people who don't like soup. So there's often kids who are like, I don't want the soup. But what a difference it makes when the soup is free. If kids are paying for the meals, they either don't want it or unfortunately can't afford it.
Yes.
And that's what we're trying to avoid. And by making it universal, not only are you having kids who will try something they may not have otherwise tried, and you're also making sure that the kids who do need that nourishing soup can have it and they're not singled out by any means. So that's the direction that this needs to go.
No, it's more than just soup too. Mm-hmm. It's soup, it's some entrees, it's some fruit, some buns.
Yeah.
But a key thing is local ingredients, trying
local
to get as much as possible. Local ingredients.
And it's developed in that direction, too. It may not have necessarily started that way. We tried as much as possible. And that's another part of the trajectory of everything is you know, the farmer's market was just sort of, it was just working at the beginning of 2021. And we had, you know, maybe like 10 to 15 vendors because they were starting to come back because Serena got that coordinated again. And now it's to year round. And the reason it's year round is because we've been able to say and look, okay, with our school meal programs, we need, and also with the family box, we need more local produce. We need our farmers. And so it was a matter of conversations with farmers saying, can you please grow more onions, more carrots, more potatoes? And those farmers saying, yes, I will. I will commit to growing more produce that we can sell to you for your school meal programs. And then also we'll have all the surplus that we can sell at a year-round winter farmers market.
You know, you use the phrase, if you build it, they will come. And what the building part is, you have an idea. You build the idea in your head. And then if it's an idea that catches on because it's fundamental to human well-being, it's just a matter of time. It's
yes.
Like you will be on our side eventually, even if you're not there yet, because what we're doing is very basic to human nature.
We are looking at the future, though, too. And we understand.
Well, the idea is timeless. The idea of having everybody have adequate food, clothing, and shelter, it's hard to say, oh, that's a weird and wacky new idea. We never thought of that before. It's built into what we as humans need, basic needs.
A lot of the mentality, though, in other places is just buy as much produce as you can for as cheaply as possible. So go buy the carrots that are from California. We have adopted the mentality, because we are Eat Local, understanding that we want our farmers to thrive so that they maintain farmland here, so that they do well, so that we have farmers for if imports, when imports don't come or are outpriced for us. We need our food here, and we can only do that if we're buying local and not just trying to get as much as possible for as little as possible.
But there's also this fundamental issue that is emerging in everybody's life, and that is that we are kind of messing with the planet's metabolism by having food come from Mexico and having food come from China and having food come from Florida. And whether we like it or not, the planet has finite limits to what it will tolerate. You know, the mother who says, no, you're being bad boys and girls, I'm going to have to chastise you. And that's happening more and more. It's more visible to people and they can see it. And local food, when all the highways were washed out, became clearly advantageous.
Yes.
There was places in the shelves where certain products were abundant, and that's because they came from down the road a little bit. The extent of this Super Meals program is fairly significant. I've got a number here, 45,000 meals in 23-24.
Yeah, and where the trajectory is much greater. You know, again, the Super Meals was a project. It was a pilot project to start using some of these sort of seasonal excess produce. How can we make sure that we're getting some of these soup days to these schools? And it just, you know, it was a slow and steady growth. And then we had provincial funding. So the Feeding Futures Fund, which started last year, is really what's allowed this to explode. And that funding, partial funding, is allowing us to be able to provide soup to these schools for free. Now, it is, again, I have to say, it's partial funding. It sounds like a really big amount of money that the province put out, but it's for all the school districts. And school district 83
told me how much it was
is very
per
big.
Student.
It's roughly $40 a student per year. When you start breaking it down, it's meant to be targeted money. It's meant to target the 20% who are food insecure. But again, if we're only targeting the people who are food insecure, you're creating stigma, and it just doesn't work.
And it also creates an uneven sense of citizens within a community, which can be interpreted as stigma, but it's also just a sense like they don't live like we do, and so they're different from us, when in fact all of our needs are really basically the same. We talked a moment ago about the concept of a vision, and you mentioned that especially with respect to Serena and the sort of direction she took the society. So let's talk a little bit about how thinking and teaching and understanding plays a role, because some of your projects and programs are very much along those lines. So let's talk about the Shuswap Community Teaching Garden. The fact that it's called a teaching garden, mm-hmm. as opposed to garden or a lovely garden or
sometimes even the confusion of a community garden, because there's a different sense of what that means.
Yeah.
Teaching, I'll just quickly go back to school meals, though, too, because Mary, taking on that role, is also then bringing in new programs to do with food literacy. And that is a big part of our objectives. We love teaching people how to cook, how to nourish themselves.
And how to grow food and how to
yes.
do all sorts of things. Because
yeah.
food does happen to play a big role in our lives.
Just a little.
Yes.
It's just a little bit important.
So
the teaching garden, you know, this, again, was a project that was created by the Shushop Family Center. And at the time, the board of the Food Action Society signed off on, you know, the grant agreements and things like that. We helped. But I would say that it was very much like
Patty
it was
Thurston.
Patty yeah. and Ebony, and they got that going. And they had a beautiful vision of what that would be. And it was going to be the clients that they would bring up and teach to grow the food, to harvest, to preserve. You know, they would bring it back to the kitchen, learn how to cook. So it's a beautiful vision. It is also just, it takes a lot of time, and it takes resources to keep it going. So, you know, back in 2019 is sort of when I said I would take on a little bit more of a role in helping just to make it grow. And at that point it was, you know, half of the garden was growing. The rest of it was, honestly, it was weeds. And
Hardy native perennials, s'il vous plaît.
Yes, you are correct. A lot of quack crap. Yes, it
yes,
was
indeed.
Very
growing
native
well.
Perennials.
Yes,
and we just wanted to make sure it kept going because, of course, it had been already now, you know, 4 years, and it had a lot of effort put into it, and we wanted to ensure that it kept going. And from there to just sort of helping it to where it is now is, we're really proud of it. It's a beautiful garden.
It is a beautiful garden. There's lots of pictures on the website, mm-hmm. and they are lovely. All the ages, all the, yeah. you know, every imaginable human being, and probably a lot of creepy crawlies in the ground that you can't see, is there.
We have
and
some thriving. Pest pressure, it's true. We.
Oh, I'm not talking about bad ones. I'm talking about earthworms. And,
we have so many earthworms, yes, because we've really built the soil. We went and adopted a no-till method.
Which is going to be the method. It's so
It has
popular.
Its pros and cons, yeah. but it's what we've chosen here. And, you know, we have it all the way from the front to the back now. And we have incredible mentorship.
Elmarie Roberts Elmarie
and Sue Moore. Totally different. You know, they do very different work. And yet everything complements each other. And incredible volunteers. I mean, I'll throw out, you know, Rita's name and Nan. Nan has been there since the beginning. Rita continues to bring, and she gets her rotary team in there, and she continues to bring new volunteers up. And that garden only succeeds and truly will only grow as much food as possible with the help of volunteers.
And when you grow, you really grow. I understand last harvest was nearly 2.5 tons, 5,000 pounds.
Every year we've grown more and more food.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And it goes to Second Harvest, another estimable organization in town. You mentioned Val and her role there, that really funnels food out into the community in a very lovely way.
Yeah, and what Val has mentioned too is, you know, the farmers who have been providing fresh produce to many of our food banks, they're getting older. They're giving up their farms. They're not doing as much. That fresh produce is such a difference. If, you know, we certainly hope that not very many people are needing to use the food bank. And we're so thankful that we have, you know, champions in town here who go and they make sure they collect any of the produce that's coming from any of our grocery stores because it's just a little bit past. But what a difference when you're looking at older carrots with their sort of dry skin to a fresh garden carrot. It, you know, a head of lettuce that's not shriveled and shrunken to fresh, still with dew drops on it, lettuce. It's an incredible difference. And do we not all have the right to that level and quality?
Of course. And we've had that as a right for thousands of years because we were much more in touch with natural processes. So we're getting back to them. Now let's talk about another garden. It's a new garden, John McLeod Community Garden.
Yes.
In memory of John McLeod, I'll say a few words about him. But started in 2024, 25, I counted the boxes,
mm-hmm.
the lovely, beautiful boxes. We humans have a tendency to put things in rows as opposed to Mother Nature scattering around. But it looks nicely.
I can't imagine that.
It looks likely loose. 25 people. And there's a waiting list for people who want to be part of it. And it's done in collaboration with the Fall Fair people, the Shushop Agricultural Association. What's its modus operandi and what's it doing?
I mean, that came together purely through the stars aligning. And I want to believe that that was meant to be. We actually applied for a grant.
As a former wedding planner, you have said something that resonates with just about everybody in the universe.
So we applied for a grant many years ago to build a community garden on the fairgrounds. and we didn't get the grant, and it was not a good place. And so I believe that it was just all meant to be. And everything that allowed us to be inside this fence line, because that is important. Being within a fence is important. As much as we don't want to believe it is, it is. So the fact that that land came available, it just, everything, it's the right collaboration. Yep. The fact that the Roots and Blues was having renovations done, and that the college had 16 carpentry students on site, the fact that they had machinery over there and fill that they needed, like everything just happened the way it was supposed to. And it came to be in a couple of months, and it was a big undertaking, but we're very proud of it and looks awesome.
And there's a lovely sign outside at the edge of the garden that says, building community around local food. That's got to be a tagline that everybody would be happy to have attached to what they're doing.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, and people who garden there, how do they, what do? Do they get their seeds from Buckerfields, or they get what?
That's totally up to them. We have general guidelines. We are seeking that people are using natural methods. You know, whether they use a hybrid seed or an heirloom, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
No seeds. P.S. No seeds are GMO, except for the ones that are big commodity crops. But they might be hybrid or they might be heirloom.
Sure.
Nobody's seed saving in our garden. You can't do that in a small space like that. Except, well, okay, anyways. we want people to not use synthetic fertilizer. So we have some guidelines and conditions because, you know, if they choose not to use their plot the following year, we want to make sure that the soil's integrity is intact.
Sure,
And so we take some level of control of that. But really what they choose to grow, the seeds that they want, we certainly encourage sharing. You know, we have a shed there and we have get-togethers. And at the beginning of the season, this upcoming season, we'll have some gardening classes so that we can better plan layouts based, you know, because it's a small mm-hmm. space. You have to be really diligent on how you decide to lay your garden out.
And what kind of people have signed up?
It's all kinds of people. We have a young mom with her daughter. We have, you know, a younger family. We have older ladies. We have older couples. We have younger men. Like it's everyone. And they live in general in the downtown areas. A lot of them can just walk to the garden. Some don't. But it is, I have been so pleased to see the community of people who have come together, who help each other. It was hot. And I mean, you know, as much as we thought there was a great volume of soil, those beds needed watering every day. And yes, they helped each other, you know, and they would keep an eye on things. It really, that is the benefit of a community garden. And I want to see them all over the place.
You know, there's a phrase, it's a title of a book called How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Yes, I have that.
I think we do put a community garden at the top of the list, not some fancy marketing slogan, but people getting together around a community mm-hmm. garden. I can't imagine a better way to win friends and influence people. Again, I'd remind listeners that I'm talking with Melanie Bennett, the project and volunteer coordinator for the Shoeshop Food Action Society. Just for listeners who may not remember John McLeod, although it's very hard to not remember him because he was a very memorable person, he is one of the founders of the Shoeshop Food Action Society, an early president, and a longtime member of the Municipal Environmental Advisory Committee, and he started up the Municipal Agricultural Advisory Committee. And I think the sign that I read out, building community around local food, would be a phrase that John would endorse 300%
yes.
and make a big joke about too as well. Now, let's go through some of the other projects because we need to let listeners know how the breadth of what the society is actually doing. Of course, the farmer's market we've mentioned already. It's now coordinated by Christine.
Yeah.
Howie has moved on to
yeah.
other geographical locations. Does yeah. he still keep in touch?
Oh, he's still a part of the board.
All right.
Yeah, so we absolutely still have
on
Howie
Zoom?
As part. That's right. He's a part of us still. He always will be. We're thankful for everything that he gave so much time.
Oh yes, indeed.
To being here. So it's strange not seeing him.
It was one of my highlights of visiting the markets, go out and have a chat with Howie. But it's also a real destination. People come there for socialization. They come there to get fresh food. They come there for a cup of coffee, and just, you know, shooting the breeze with a lot of really nice people in a really nice state of mind. Now, one feature of the market is it's a place for BC Nutrition coupons to be used. Would just a tagline on that?
Yeah, that is a BC Farmers Market Association coupon. So this is a provincially funded initiative where they provide an allocation of money to the BC Farmers Market, who then distributes it through different towns that have a farmers market. And those dollars actually go to the family center. So the Shoe Shop Family Center holds the market coupons, who then give them out. We have a set amount of dollars that can be given. And so they give them out to families who then can come to the market and use them to redeem them to our farmers. It's just a dollar amount. So then the farmer at the end of the day, they can give us the coupon. So we collect them and then we're able to reimburse them through that sort of that pot.
Lovely circular system.
Yeah.
And it's worth mentioning also, there's a little music sometimes at the farmer's market. It's not always that easy when the snow is falling and the rain is...
That's only in the summertime. Yeah, and that's, exactly. I would also say that's sponsored by Saskia.
Thank you very much, Saskia.
Mm, yes.
Shoe Shop Family Boxes.
The Shoe Shop Family Boxes came about, again, back in 2021 when all of a sudden just, you know, life changed. And there was too many families who, because schools closed, but yet people still need to eat, right? So if those kids were having the breakfast or lunch programs at those schools, now all of a sudden the family didn't actually, they weren't receiving that. And so in order to sort of lighten up that load, there was some COVID relief funding that came through. It was channeled through the school district. And, you know, a set amount of families were recognized. And what we did, though, is take those dollars again. And instead of going to Sysco, Costco and buying food, we chose to use that money and we bought local food.
Which is a good thing to do. And it's up to $150,000 invested in the program so far.
Yeah, and we're still working on those stats. It's probably even more. But I would also say, like, so many of those farmers, like, we had people, farmers that were, like, donating whole chickens. Those boxes were receiving organic bread, fresh produce, venison meat. I mean, it was a beautiful box of food that was going either picked up, sometimes delivered. I mean, our volunteers were out there delivering some of these boxes, too, because not everybody has a car. They can't get there to pick it up.
Let's talk now about a third garden, and it's sort of an indirect garden, and that is the Project Grow Youth Garden Contest. That's the full title, but it's got several parts. It's got the growing of food, kids growing food, and then having a contest to produce the best carrot, the best beet. Why don't you describe that? Jasmine Evans is coordinating that.
Jim McEwen from the fair.
Old Jim McEwen. He's really changed the complexion of what goes on.
We have so many great talks and he has so many great ideas and love working with him. He can sort of bounce ideas off us and then, you know, where it fits and how what we can make happen, we do. And so that started 2 years ago and we were really pleased with the reaction. So we put it out. We took some of the information from the Summerland Fair, who started it. They were doing it for 25 years. So we just took some of those ideas,
and
adapted it to
it.
Ourselves, partnered with Buckerfields, who was really happy to do it. They provided seeds, plants, some fertilizer. And then we worked with Jasmine to create some mentorship. And we had that first year, we had 60 people register right off the bat, which was really surprising. But not everybody goes the distance, and that's okay. But it was 34 youth who ultimately went all the way through, grew a garden.
Now it's 60.
Well, that's 60 all the way through. Okay. So last year we had 32 youth who went all the way from start to finish too. Some came back, which was nice to see. Some were new. And basically, you know, these kids sign up. It's all free. They get these things. If we have allowed, like if people wanted help financially to get a garden started, this was a part of what Shoe Shop Food Action would do. But we were really thankful to the Shoe Shop Agricultural Association and SASCU who came together to give pretty significant RESP prizes. And I mean, a kid might not really be like, oh, I want an RESP, but the parents do, and they will make sure that the kids keep going. It was meant to be the children were the ones who were growing the garden, and we asked for pictures. And so we would have them uploading to their top secret Google folder, and we would see their journey and their trajectory. We would see pictures of kids drawing out their labels, doing a garden plan. So it was really rewarding. We're so excited to do it again this year, too. We're going to do two different age groups this year. We're going to do 8 to 10-year-olds, and we're going to do 11 to 13. Now, the 11 to 13, they're going to have probably a little bit more higher standards that they'll have to follow, and we'll have our criteria sheet. But then the 8 to 10s, it's certainly more about like the fun, and we're looking at having individual businesses providing some gift certificates so that we can have far more winners, air quotes, winners. They're all winners. Who will then, we just want to get people and kids excited about growing a garden.
We've got a couple more programs we need to talk about and activities. One is, of course, the Lighthouse Community Food Forest, mm-hmm. which was set up by Kelly Westgate of Lecker Land Design. It's in its fourth year. It's going to be moving around a little bit. There's going to be a little bit of change.
Excited to see how the spring unfolds. Salvation Army has some great plans to expand their cafe, and that could include a commercial kitchen, more cooking, food literacy, very exciting, which will then cut into our food forest footprint. But the idea at this point is to move some of those garden beds to a different area of the grounds and create its own small community garden. So any of their clients who come through who would like to grow their own bed, that will be available. So we're going to move some things around. That has been a very challenging project, I'm not going to lie. But we're not giving up. We are going to keep doing. We will keep adapting, and we'll keep trying to grow food there.
And the principle is so profoundly important.
It is.
Grow food that anybody can pick, eat, choose, whatever. And I think that's really just taking Mother Nature's lesson and converting it into a little more human-focused form. But it really is a wonderful idea. The other thing that's happened recently is a little political activism. I mean, it runs through everything that society does, but in a formal sense, the specific thing that's happened is that a letter has been sent to the mayor and council of Salmon Arm asking for ALR land to be kept for food production. Now, many cities have started to understand this. The notion of urban gardening or urban food growing is starting to catch on. People realize, why not have food that's just around the corner as opposed to a million miles away? Now, we've paved over a lot of land that should have been kept for gardens. But Liz Blakeway, she emphasized the extremely part-time executive director of the society. There's some big chunks of land, 146 acres near the airport and 118 acres on Foothills Road. This is a substantial amount of land. And BC only has 5% of the total land area of the province is agricultural, available for agriculture. How is that factored into your thinking about how change needs to take place in thinking?
So Claire Askew, president of Shoe Shop Food Action, as well as Liz, did format that letter, and it's on our blog post. We encourage everybody to go to our website.
It's a wonderful letter.
It's a really good letter.
It covers the terrain.
Yeah, it does. And it shows and proposes some ideas of what we could do here in Salmon Arm as well for food production and ways that we could use that land. Absolutely. John was an advocate for retaining, maintaining, and using farmland. So we cannot let that go. I mean, it wasn't a big part of our work for many years, and we want it to become that. And that's why when we say part-time executive director, I mean, ideally, we do need, for all of this kind of deeper thinking, policy creation, we do need a full-time executive director, somebody who's really focused on that work. It's its own work. So we are talking with the city. I mean, the city knows that agriculture and food security is a large part of what people are looking for. It's no easy task. We know that it's hard to understand how we will build Salmon Arm. How will we house people? Totally get it. But ALR land is finite, like you said.
And it's also a big crisis, the availability of land and people who will grow things on land. It's not the traditional sons of previous farmers. It's people who are coming and saying, this is good, we've got to do it.
Yeah.
They need a space to do it in. Now, we're coming close to the end of the show, and I want to make a couple of mentions, and then we'll go back and talk about the coldest night of the year.
Sure.
The blog. There's going to be a blog. Who's going to do the blog? Anybody or everybody?
I am certainly looking for contributors. If you are somebody who loves to talk about things or write things. Now, the blog came about because we are having some incredible conversations. There are groups forming. There are people who are very passionate about many topics. So where do those conversations go? we wanted a place that we could house that kind of information that doesn't get just lost through the scrolling of social media. And so this will be a place where we can have the community contribute. It'll be vetted and read, of course. But it's under our resource tab. We also have a local food tab under resources because people need to know where could they get food assistance.
Okay, let's give Coles and I of the Year. It's when, where, what, why, quickly before we have to head off.
Cold Design of the Year is February 22nd, 2025 this year. It's a Saturday. You can start now. We have already
4 p.m.
13 teams already signed up. It'll start at 4 p.m., but all of that information is on our website. All of it works all the way up to the date. The culmination is that walking date, and it will be at downtown Saskew starting at 4 p.m. The walk itself starts at 5, and then we go and we do it. It takes around 30 minutes to 45. We will have a beautiful meal outside downtown Askew's, and that will be the finale of the coldest night of the event. But stay tuned for lots of information and activities that will be happening through January and February.
The Food Action Society is busy and will keep busy and is expanding and will keep expanding. Melanie, it's been a delight to have you on Food Conversations today.
Thank you for being with us. Thanks for the opportunity to talk.